It was for the sake of the status quo, something hardly less necessary than the forms themselves, that philosophy was bound to lose its way. Idealism was that ideological even before starting to glorify the world as an absolute ideal. The primal compensation already includes the notion that reality exalted into a product of the supposedly free subject would vindicate itself as free. Identitarian thought, the covering image of the prevailing dichotomy, has ceased in our era of subjective impotence to pose as absolutization of the subject. What is taking shape instead is the type of seemingly anti-subjectivist, scientifically objective, identitarian thought known as reductionism. The early Russell used to be called a neo-realist. It is at present the characteristic form of the reified consciousness, false, because of its latent and thus much more fatal subjectivism. The residue is made to the measure of the ordering principles of subjective reason, and being abstract itself, it agrees with the abstractiveness of that reason, the reified consciousness that mistakes itself, for nature is naive. Having evolved and being very much mediated in itself, it takes itself, to speak in Husserl's term, for a sphere of being of absolute origin, and the other it has equipped for the desired matter. The ideal of depersonalizing knowledge for objectivity's sake keeps nothing but the caput mortuum of objectivity. Once we concede the object's dialectical primacy, the hypothesis of an unreflected practical science of the object as residual after deducting the subject will collapse. The subject is then no longer a deductible addendum to objectivity. By the elimination of one of its essential elements, objectivity is falsified, not purified, and indeed the notion that guides objectivity's residual concept has its primal image in something posited and man-made, by no means in the idea of that in itself for which it substitutes the cleansed object. Page 506. It is the model of profit rather that stays on the balance sheet after all costs of production have been subtracted. Profit, however, is the subjective interest limited and reduced to the form of calculation. What counts for the sober realism of profit thinking is anything but the matter. The matter is submerged in the yield, but cognition would have to be guided by what exchange has not maimed, or for nothing is left unmaimed by what the exchange processes are hiding. The object is no more a subjectless residuum than what the subject posits. The two contradictory definitions fit into each other. The residue, which science can be put off as its truth, is the product of their subjectively organized manipulative procedures. Defining what the object is would in turn be part of such arrangements. The only way to make out objectivity is to reflect at each historic and each cognitive step on what is then presented as subject and object, as well as on the mediation. In that sense, the object is indeed infinitely given, as neo-Kantianism taught. At times, the subject as unlimited experience will come closer to the object than the filtered residuum shaped to fit the requirements of subjective reason. According to its present polemic value in the philosophy of history, unreduced subjectivity can function more objectively than objectivism. Reductions. Not the least respect in which all knowledge under the spell has been hexed is that traditional epistemological thesis put the case upside down. Fair is foul and foul is fair. The objective content of individual experience is not produced by the methods of comparative generalization. It is produced by dissolving what keeps that experience as being biased itself from yielding to the object without reservations, as Hegel put it, with the freedom that would relax the cognitive subject until it truly fades into the object to which it is akin, on the strength of its own objective being. The subject's key position in cognition is empirical, not formal. What Kant calls formation is essential deformation. The preponderant exertion of knowledge is destruction of its usual exertion, that of using violence against the object. Approaching knowledge of the object is the act in which the subject rends the veil it is weaving around the object. It can do this only where, fearlessly, passive, it entrusts itself to its own experience. In places where subjective reason sends subjective contingency, the primacy of the object is shimmering through. Whatever in the object is not a subjective admixture. The subject is the object's agent, not its constituent. This fact has consequences for the relation of theory and practice. Page 507. Even after the second reflection of the Copernican turn, there remains some truth in Kant's most questionable theorem. In the distinction between the transcendent thing in itself and the constituted object, for then the object would be the non-identical, free from the subjective spell and comprehensible through its self-criticism. It is there at all, if indeed it is not what Kant outlined in its concept of the ideal. Such non-identity would come quite close to Kant's thing in itself, even so he insisted on the vanishing points of its coincidence with the subject. It would not be a relic on the disenchanted mundus intelligibilis. Rather, it would be more real than the mundus sensibilis, insofar as Kant's Copernican turn abstracts from that non-identity and therein finds its barrier. But then the object, along Kantian lines, is what we have been posited by the subject, the web of subjective forms cast over the unqualified something. And finally, it is the law that combines the phenomena integrated by their subjective relation into an object. The attributes is of necessity and generality that Kant attaches to the emphatic concept of the law have the solidity of things and are impenetrably equal to that social world with which the living collide. It is that law, according to Kant, which the subject prescribes to nature in his conception. It is the highest peak of objectivity, the perfect expression of the subject as well as of its self-alienation at the peak of its formative pretension. The subject passes itself off as an object. Paradoxically, however, this is not wrong at all. In fact, the subject is an object as well. It only forgets in its formal hypostasis how and whereby it was constituted. Kant's Copernican turn hits the exact objectification of the subject. The reality of reification, its truth content, is by no means ontological, but historically a massed plaque between subject and object. The subject erects that plaque by claiming supremacy over the object and thereby defrauding itself of the object. As truly non-identical, the object moves the farther from the subject, the more the subject constitutes the object. The block on which Kantian philosophy erects its brain is at the same time a product of that philosophy, and yet, due to the chorismus of any material, the subject as pure spontaneity and original apperception, seemingly the absolutely dynamic principle, is no less reified than the world of things constituted after the model of natural science. For by that chorismus, the claimed absolute spontaneity is brought to a halt in itself, though not for Kant it is a form supposed to be the form of something, but one which due to its own character cannot interact with any something. Page 508. Its abrupt divorcement from the activity of individual subjects, an activity that has to be devalued as contingent psychological, destroys Kant's inmost principle, original apperception. His a priorism deprives pure action of the very temporality without which simply nothing can be understood by dynamics. Action recoils into a second-class being, explicitly, as everyone knows, in the late Fichte's turn away from the 1794 theory of science. Kant codifies such objective ambiguities in the concept of the object, and no theorem about the object has the right to ignore it. Strictly speaking, primacy of the object would mean that there is no object as the subject's abstract opposite, but that as such it seems necessary. The necessity of that illusion ought to be removed. No more, to be sure, is there really a subject. Its hypostasis in idealism leads to absurdities. They may be summarized like this: that the definition of the subject involves what it is posited against, and by no means only because as a constituents it presupposes a constitutum. The subject itself is an object insofar as existence is implied by the idealist doctrine of constitution. There must be a subject to that. It can constitute anything at all, insofar as this has been borrowed in turn from the sphere of facility. The concept of what is there means nothing but what exists, and the subject as existent comes promptly under the heading of object. As pure apperception, however, the subject claims to be the downright other of all existence. This, too, is the negative appearance of a slice of truth that the reification with the sovereign subject has inflicted on everything, including itself, is mere illusion. The subject moves into the chasm of itself, whatever would be exempt from reification, with the absurd result, of course, of thereby issuing a permit for all other reification. By idealism, the idea of truth, life, is wrongly objected inwards. The subject as productive imagination, as pure apperception, finally as free action, encodes that activity in which human life is really reproduced. And in that activity, it logically anticipates freedom. This is why so little of the subject will simply vanish in the object or in anything supposed to be higher, in being as it may be hypostasized. The self-positing subject is an illusion and at the same time historically very real. It contains the potential of sublating its own rule. The difference between subject and object cuts through both the subject and the object. It can no more be absolutized than it can be put out of mind. Actually, everything in the subject is chargeable to the object. Whatever part of it is not objective will semantically burst the is. Page 509. According to its own concept,